Greetings. All right. Yes, it's Thursday night. I know. Coming to you a few hours early. This because producer Robbie has another commitment. And really, the show doesn't run well without him. So we have to accommodate the producer. And the host's needs do come second here. So glad that you are patient with us as we reorganize the schedule. Dr. Audio is here, which means we can get started. Sam Rajofsky, Sam Nation here from the Sam Nation Studios, deep behind the orange curtain, Thursday night about 7 o'clock in the evening. It has been a busy news week, has it not? Brett Kavanaugh announced as the Supreme Court nominee by President Trump on Monday. I will discuss that as the program unfolds. But I want to here quickly address the NATO summit that has been transpiring over the last couple of days. Trump tonight is already in Great Britain. He is attending a gala event at Blenheim Palace. And this is the birthplace of Churchill, Winston Churchill. This is a stunning piece of property. If you haven't been, it's a spectacular place. And Trump is there. He landed by helicopter, came in on Marine One, touches down in the courtyard, comes out wearing his tuxedo, Melania looking great. And everybody in the media right now is melting. I've seen news stories about anywhere from fearing that Trump would try to plant a kiss on the Queen to worries that that he would, I don't know, be annoyed with her dogs when he meets her. I think he's meeting the Queen tomorrow. This is all this hysteria, by the way, was on full display when he was conducting his meetings with NATO, with our valued and trusted allies in Western Europe. Now, the media, and I have clips, so I will play the actual evidence of this here in a second. But the media, predictably, anything that Trump does, it's terrible, it's wrong, it's bad. It's funny because for years, Obama turned his back on our traditional allies, pissed all over the Western world and the world order as it had been for much of post-war history. No problem. Media never was concerned about this. But Trump comes in, sits down with NATO, and basically gives them a giant dressing down. I thought it kind of looked to me like a father, you know, bringing his adult screw-up child, sitting him down. You know, listen, son, you're 32 years old. You're still living at home with mom and dad. Jesus Louise, get your crap together. And that's kind of how it was. In fact, I will play a clip for you here just to give you a little taste of what happened. This is Trump speaking to a panel of NATO luminaries about Germany. Listen to this.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they will be getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO, and I don't think it should have happened. And I think we have to talk to Germany about it. Germany is a captive of Russia because they supply. They got rid of their coal plants. They got rid of their nuclear. They're getting so much of the oil and gas from Russia. I think it's something that NATO has to look at. I think it's very inappropriate. You and I agree that it's inappropriate. I don't know what you can do about it now, but it certainly doesn't seem to make sense that they pay billions of dollars to Russia, and now we have to defend them against Russia.
Everything you need to know is contained exactly in this quote. Now, and this quote, incidentally, this breakfast dressing down that Trump gave the Europeans is being taken to mean quite literally Trump is absolutely turning his back on our traditional allies. And this is a wrong way to read it. I actually think it's a incredibly brave assertion of recognized fact. The way NATO works, incidentally, just so you understand this, NATO is a confederation of countries. It's a treaty by which The countries that are in it swear, promise to protect one another if any of them individually are attacked. So it's one of these attack one, you attack us all. The United States has always played a critical role in NATO because in post-war Europe, indeed in the post-war world, you have, the United States was an 800-pound gorilla. And as a major player, well, besides just being a major player, the United States, of course, had a vested interest in containing the spread of socialism, of communism, and the Soviets. And the policy of containment meant, hey, it's bad enough that they've taken Eastern Europe. We've drawn a line. The Iron Curtain has fallen, as Winston Churchill said. And now we must contain it and make sure that we do everything. We signal through strength, through dollars spent, through military might provided, know-how, etc., that the Soviet Union not spread any further. Now, this paradigm, in a sense, ends at the end of the Cold War, but continues and becomes more relevant again with the rise of Russia. And as Russia becomes more powerful and begins to perhaps make some imperialist noises, and that's still part of Russian thinking, is expanding into Europe. There are a lot of little countries that are very nervous about that. My parents' home state, Czechoslovakia, or formerly Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic, being one of them. So, to be clear, and Trump understands this keenly, you don't contribute money directly to NATO. What you do, each member state is required to contribute its military. And it's required by treaty, by contract that they signed, to spend a certain amount of their GDP on their military. Now, what's happened over the years in Europe is as all these countries have become wacko socialistic nightmares, socialism, by the way, you guys, we all understand socialism isn't cheap. It costs money. It costs money to pay people to produce nothing. This is a fact. So what countries have been doing is while their welfare rolls have been going up, while they've been inviting, the millions of migrants into their country and giving them each, thousands upon thousands of euros a year, at the same time, they're running out of money to spend on their military. And they're looking to us, to the United States, to bridge the gap. Trump is 100% right to call BS on this. That is what this is all about. This isn't an existential argument about NATO. Should it exist? Should it remain? Yes or no? It's just about money. It's about fairness. This is about being taken advantage of. And I actually think, more specifically, it's about socialist spendthrift countries. They are spending money like drunken whores. And what are now they turn to us, you and I, as U.S. taxpayers, and say, well, can you pick up the slack a little bit here on this defense side? Because, we really can't spend money on our militaries because we're too busy, paying Algerian migrants or Syrian migrants. This kind of thing has been happening in Europe. Now, where it comes to the energy thing, and this has been talked about a whole bunch. If you heard about these comments about what Trump said about to Germany, about the Russian pipeline, how dare they? How dare they? But this is a huge deal. If you are in Europe, this is a huge deal. And it's a huge deal because countries in Europe, because of wacko environmentalists, because of the green parties in various states that become parts of the government, their political system is crazier than ours. In a parliamentary system, to get a majority, when you have 25 parties, it's not going to be one party that's in power. And these governments, especially in Germany, have always brought in the Green Party to sort of fill a majority seat and become a governing coalition. So that means that they have to cater to those crazy environmental parties. And one of the ways they do that, they shut down coal plants. They shut down nuclear power plants. They have nuclear power plants that they've decommissioned. It's literally insane. And to make up for it, what do? They bring in fuel, be it natural gas or whatnot, or electricity from Russia. But when you become energy dependent on a state that is your declared enemy, at least vis-a-vis NATO, right, and the NATO treaty, what are you looking at? It's massively hypocritical for Germany to not spend what they promised to spend to contribute meaningfully to NATO. At the same time, to engage in their wacko environmentalism that sees their means of producing energy shuttered, and then turn to the enemy that they are asking us to pick up the slack on defending and go, hey, guys, hey, Russians, by the way, let's make a deal. Now, being energy dependent on the outside when you're an independent state is a little bit like living at mom and dad's. It comes with strings attached. At least generally it does. And it is a very, very dangerous thing. So every characterization of Trump as a buffoon, as somebody who doesn't get it, who's just stepping all over it, is absolutely wrong. He actually gets it. I'm sure other presidents have gotten it too, but they've always, like Obama, more interested in comedy than having, you know, than really confronting a serious issue. And I think the big picture, I think what's meaningful about this is that you're much more likely, it's like a relationship, it's like a marriage. You're far more likely to have a better relationship, a better marriage, if you confront the difficult issues, say them right, straight up, put them out there, and solve the problem. And remember, Trump wants to negotiate. He wants a better deal for us. He wants our European allies to step up. And he wants to negotiate with Russia when he meets with Putin from a position of strength. And a position of strength is, yeah, I've got all the Europeans together now. They're all spending more money on defense. Our position as a NATO alliance is far stronger than it was under Obama. Sit down and let's talk. That is a great place to come from. But the Democrats are too busy chasing Trump-Russia collusion and he's not an ally. He's burning our allies, and this is just terrible. Anderson Cooper on Wednesday actually went as far as to say Trump doesn't understand how NATO works. Listen to this.
The president's suggestion is that NATO is a dues-paying organization that members chip into some pot for collective defense, that they don't pay their fair share. They haven't been for years, and they owe the U.S. money. Now, keep it honest, as you'll see, that is simply not the case. It's not the way it works. It's not even close. It is, however, the way President Trump believes it works. He campaigned on the notion. He was elected on it. He's tweeted about it throughout the presidency, including on the flight over.
God, this is so wrong. They take Trump so literally. That's the mistake all these bozos make. They don't understand that it is easier to say pay your fair share than it is to start explaining the way I did that. Well, you're contributing. Each state is contributing to its military, and then those militaries are then contributed to the general, collective military force that is NATO. That doesn't fit into a tweet. It doesn't stick in people's minds, but the concept of fairness does. And Trump's a brilliant communicator, and he's getting across He's making a relatively arcane issue of 1% GDP versus 2% GDP. He's making those type of things very understandable by average American voter. And of course, Anderson Cooper doesn't like it because it's virtually guaranteeing that the Trump train move forward and continue blowing through each station. Here's MSNBC political analyst Stephen Schmidt talking with Brian Williams about Trump's supposed indifference to NATO.
To see a president of the United States indifferent to this institution, indifferent to these allies and their sacrifices, indifferent to the shared values of liberty and freedom that bind all of our countries together, when we see him indifferent to that, it's a tragic day. When you weaken the most important military alliance in the history of the world, you make the world a more dangerous place, and you're doing Vladimir Putin's bidding, who has no higher strategic goal than to unravel the European Union and to unravel the NATO alliance.
This is total drivel, okay? And by the way, though, this right now is a mainstream position, that somehow Trump going in, he's going into NATO with a wrecking ball, and he wants to do Vladimir Putin's bidding. Now, when I come back, I'll explain exactly why that's wrong, because I think it comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of Europe. And how this all works. And also remember this is really anything Trump does. I mean, Trump could do exactly what Obama did. Do all the same things. And where Obama was given accolades, Trump would be given poopsicles. Okay, trust me. No matter what he does it wrong. Don't go anywhere. Back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
So let me see if I understand this, right? So, according to MSNBC, Trump is doing Vladimir Putin's bidding by smacking around NATO. You know what the net result so far has been of Trump's complaining about the fair share pay, the fair share contribution in to NATO? What's been the net result? The net result has been, here, you ready for it? More money to NATO. Yes, that's right. He's been complaining, and their number of member states have begun upping their spend, their military spend domestically. That's exactly what they ought to be doing. Do you know who agrees with me? None other than NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Here he is in a Q&A session talking to or answering a question by CNN pundit Barbara Starr. Now, he listen to this.
Does he really understand NATO? He says people aren't paying their fair share. Well, nobody pays to NATO, of course.
President Trump has a direct language, plain speaking, sometimes very direct, pointing at specific allies. But when it comes to the core message, we actually all agree that NATO doesn't share the burden in a fair way. The U.S. has been pushing for more spending for many, many years. Now, actually, something has started to happen. This is something that the U.S. can take credit for.
Yeah, that's it. And we need to, as a leadership body, always within the NATO alliance, this is our role. I don't understand. And listen, this is why Trump is a business guy, right? So business people are fundamentally different than career politicians. And when it comes to things like this, a problem that has existed for years, this is not a new problem. We have been picking up the slack for decades. But when it comes to something like this, this is where a president like Obama's, a president like Bush, a president like Clinton that are career politicians, they're not going to get it done because they want to play nice and they want to play diplomat. And they care more about warm, fuzzy feelings in the moment than they care about accomplishing anything. And Trump comes in there like a wrecking ball because he wants to accomplish it. He wants to get it done. You know, when you deal with when you interact with successful people, people who have businesses, who have responsibility, and a lot of them very impatient. Try having a conversation with a high level CEO. And if you start going off, you know, you start going off in one direction and they don't like where you're going, they're cut you off and we're getting back on track. Every conversation has an objective. And I know that the left is busy smearing Trump as being a buffoon, but meanwhile, he actually is, he's keeping this on track, and he gives zero you-know-whats about what anybody in that room thinks of him. He doesn't care if Angela Merkel drops dead. He doesn't care if Theresa May hates him. You know what? Actually, it's almost unbelievable that we have a politician, Trump, who is doing what he promised to in the election. Because in the election, he promised to put us ahead of all these schmucks. And he's doing it. He is our president. He's not Mr. World Citizen like Obama was. He's not Mr. Compassionate Conservative like George Bush was. He's not Mr. I'm going to diddle everything that walks around like Bill Clinton was. He's going there and he's cracking heads and making things happen. And if the net result of it is that we end up with a stronger NATO that better checks Russia and that costs us less money, isn't that a win-win? Isn't that what we in the business world call a no-lose situation, a no-lose outcome? If we've stripped away Trump from this and we stripped away the politics about it, and this was just raw dollars in your pocket, if we were talking about your mutual fund, you know, 10 out of 10 Americans would absolutely agree on this. But I truly believe that what the result of all of this, as Trump uses his brash style that gets criticized by the MSMs, that then in turn yields a successful outcome, as that happens over and over and over again, it only cements his success story. And that success story becomes a rallying cry in 2020. Legal segment up next. You don't want to miss this one. Question. If the TSA, you know, the people that give you pat-downs at the airport, if they cross the line, can you sue them? Complicated. I'll answer it when we come back. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Majowski, Sam Nation, legal segment. Yes, your favorite attorney is here. Presiding, what happens if that nightmare of nightmares comes true at the airport when you are manhandled, pushed around, harassed, sexually groped, whatever it is, by a overzealous TSA agent? You know, I actually think that this probably happens quite a bit more than is even reported. Well, we've all had this experience. These TSA agents, as you know, you get in the airport, you get there, and they have all the power over you, don't they? And they pull you out of the line and say, okay, you're up. And next thing you know, their hands are all over you. They're going through your bag. They're going through your briefcase, your purse, whatnot. And this happened to a lady. It happened to a lady named Pellegrino. Now, she's in, she was in Florida. Nadine Pellegrino. She's from Boca Raton, Florida. She's flying with her husband. And she's at the Philadelphia airport. She gets singled out. They start patting her down. She goes, I want to be in a private room. And by asking to be in a private room, they took offense to it. And you can picture how this happened. And basically, these four agents, these four TSA people, begin to mess with her. And they provoke her. And at some point, she aggressively pulls her suitcase off the counter when she's done with it. And it hits one of them in the leg. Now, they call over the police, have her arrested. She ends up, I think, in jail for 16 hours, has to post a $400 bond. It doesn't stop there. The district attorney locally then takes the case and charges her with 10 criminal counts, including making terroristic threats. She's later acquitted by a jury, and she files a lawsuit. Now, something very important about these federal lawsuits, you cannot sue, generally speaking, you can't sue the federal government. The federal government is our sovereign. I know that's a term that's a lot of, you know, used to describe kings and queens, but it's a technical term. The state is all powerful, okay? And checked only by the Constitution. Thank goodness we've got that Constitution. But one of the things that the state has to do by virtue of our law is to give permission to be sued. And that is exactly what Congress does. They create exceptions to something called sovereign immunity. So the federal government generally cannot be sued except where Congress has allowed an exception to exist. Now, there is an exception in the law. And the exception, well, one of them is that if you are a police officer or an investigative officer, like you'd say, for example, an FBI agent, and under, you know, acting in under the color of law, that person violates, for example, your rights, false imprisonment, battery, that type of thing. So this case, this lady loses in the district court, in the lower court, in the trial court, and takes it up to the Third Circuit. And in the Third Circuit, what they basically decide is they decide that, no, she doesn't have a case because TSA are not officers. Now, I've read the decision. I'm going to tell you, as of right now, if the question is, can I sue the TSA for screwing with me? The answer is no. Because as it stands right now, the highest court that has reviewed this, which is a district, an appeals court, court of appeals, U.S. appeals court, this is law right now. They have decided that no. In fact, if you are a TSA agent, you're not technically a police officer. Now, I'm a little bit up against the clock. When I come back, let me explain to you why this is total nonsense. Yeah, and this is good. It's good to know this stuff because these cases will always come up. And I actually suspect that this particular case will make its way up to the Supreme Court. I can't imagine. And that's because the Supreme Court previously has given some guidelines on what is and isn't a police officer under the law. I'll get to this when we come back. And I also think, by the way, I also think that this is why judges matter. I'll be back right after this. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation on Sam Nation Radio.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation. Look, if you get punched in the face by a TSA officer, producer Robbie just asked this during the break, what happens if the TSA guy just slaps me? Well, according to this Third Circuit opinion, you can't even sue. You can't even file a lawsuit. And forget the case being heard by a judge or a jury. You cannot file a lawsuit. Now, let me tell you why they made that decision. As I was explaining earlier, they made the decision, and I'll actually read from the opinion of the court here. Based on our review of the statute's text, purpose, legislative history, etc., we hold that TSA screeners are not investigative or law enforcement officers under the law enforcement proviso. And the plaintiff's claims are therefore barred by the government's sovereign immunity statute. That's from the decision. Now, when you go to the actual federal law, this is where it gets interesting. All right, so under Section 2680, it says, subsection H, for the purpose of this subsection, quote, investigative or law enforcement officer, close quote, means any officer of the United States who is empowered by law to execute searches, to seize evidence, or to make arrests for violations of federal law. What's the most important word in there? Robbie, what's the most important word in that sentence? What's the most important word? I think the most important word is the or. And the reason for that is the or is not an and. And when you read statutes, the and makes all those things cumulative. You have to have all those elements. An or means any one of those elements, just one. If the TSA, what the hell does the TSA do if they don't execute searches? Tell me what the heck a TSA agent is doing rummaging through my bag if they're not executing a search. What in Sam's hell are they doing patting somebody down if they're not allowed to execute a search? And I'm pretty damn skippy straight sure that if a TSA agent finds contraband, like, for example, I read this week that a woman on her way from Miami to Barbados had hidden a boa constrictor inside of a computer hard drive. Did you see this? Or inside a computer case. It was very cleverly hidden. Well, what do you think the TSA did when they found the boa constrictor? Yeah, they seized it as evidence. I don't know where they got this. And this is the, by the way, this is where judges have to interpret the law as written. And this is the discussion now surrounding Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's Supreme Court nominee. And a great deal is being made of the fact that he is a plain reader of the Constitution, is a plain reader of the law. And this is the type of judge that we want. The lady judge that came down with this idiotic opinion, her name is Sheryl Ann Krause, and she was a Barack Obama appointee. So I don't know where the outrage is on any of this. Certainly, if you're a civil libertarian, I actually think a number of people on the left should think this is outrageous, because it leaves the American public with little to no redress from victimization by a group of people that are almost universally hated and loved, but can do a tremendous amount of damage. The reason the law enforcement proviso was put in by Congress was to check the powers of the state, was to give you and I the ability to fight back if our Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment rights were violated. It's very important. And that's, you know, I'm not just saying this as a personal injury attorney. I'm saying, look, there's the tort law is a balancer, and it allows for you and I to address our, it allows for you and I to fight back. It really does. So there it is. Judges matter. I do see this case going up to the Supreme Court, and hopefully Justice Kavanaugh is and his colleagues are a little wiser on this, because this is just idiocy. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rogowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, more legal news. Stormy Daniels was arrested in Ohio. I don't know if you heard about this, but she apparently has been on a tour of the United States, showing off her assets. And I guess in Ohio and Cleveland, she did a little more than just show off her assets. She used parts of her body, which could be described as her quote-unquote moneymakers, to batter the face of an undercover Cleveland police officer. I'm not going to get into any greater detail. This is a family program. But suffice it to say that she was arrested on the spot, hauled off, and today, all these charges were dropped because they're the I guess the Yeah, the in strip joints, I don't even, this is not my area of expertise, thank goodness, but apparently there's some no contact rule in most jurisdictions. But in Ohio, the statute is written only for regular employees of a strip club. And she wasn't a regular employee. She was there for, one night only. I am very sad that she was arrested. I want Stormy Daniels, I was just talking about this earlier here. I want her to be able to go out there and strip and strip and strip away so she will have enough money to pay Trump when he prevails on his case against her for violating the NDA. That's the real story here. I mean, the real story, it's not about Michael Avenatti. It's not about Michael Cohen. It's not about any of this, Stormy, whatever. She made a deal. She got money. It wasn't an insignificant sum either. What was it, $120,000, $140,000, something like that? She took the money. She cashed the check. She spent it. And in exchange for that, she made an oath not to talk about their affair. Now, none of us believe Trump when he denies it, okay? I mean, just that ship has sailed. But what we all, I guess, viscerally understand, I think at least I do, is that the hoe took the money. And you know, there's a contract there. I bet you, I bet you could get a jury that would make her pay up. I think in the contract, too, there's something there's a specific proviso in there that says what the damages are. It's something like $1 million per violation or something crazy. And we call that, by the way, do you know what that's called in a contract when you have a specific amount of damages already put in? So if X, then you're going to have Y amount of damages. It's called liquidated damages. And it's actually really handy because then you don't have to litigate, okay, what are the actual damages? What you just decide, did Stormy violate the no talk clause? And if she blabbed, which we all know she did because she was on TV, we all saw her, well, then X. And she signed up for it. And those things, by the way, they're enforceable. So we'll see how that goes. All right, when we come back, I want to talk Brett Kavanaugh. It's so fascinating to me because there's a political context to this. Everything that is happening with Kavanaugh's appointment is political. And I think there's some interesting implications here. So more on this when we come back. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Well, hey, here we go. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, second hour of radio greatness. We're talking about Brett Kavanaugh. Now, I want to give you a little spoiler alert here, friends. Kavanaugh is going to get confirmed. The only caveat really here is, I suppose, if it comes out that Kavanaugh, perhaps, let's say, is a secret member of a neo-Nazi movement, or maybe if there's a dead hooker in his basement, something like that. Look, barring some crazy thing that comes out, if what we see is what we get, Kavanaugh is in. So I have to tell you, if that's, and look, this is not just Sam conventional wisdom. This is not just your host here opining from deep behind the orange curtain. Smart people inside Washington understand this is how it works. The president appoints a qualified candidate, and the Senate's role is advice and consent. And they have to give their consent if the person is qualified. It has never, traditionally, never been it's always a political thing. But in the end, I mean, look, Sotomayor and Yeah, not just the wise Latina, but other justices. They all get, I mean, Republicans, Democrats, they all vote together. And that's what the Senate is about. All of this, what you are hearing from Senate leadership, from the Democratic Party, from Chuck Schumer, is all a bunch of election year posturing. And in my opinion, this strategy is a no-win, lose-lose deal for them. Well, okay, let me explain. For Schumer, okay, we're talking about the Senate. And there's a handful of Senate races here. But he also has a handful of very vulnerable members who are up for election. In fact, the conventional wisdom, we've talked about this many times, is that there's a very real possibility that as long as Trump continues to do well and there isn't broad disgust with Trump's policies outside of major metropolitan centers in blue states, the Senate likely will gain 1 to 2, possibly 3 or more, Republican senators. The Senate right now hangs in a balance, but it's, if anything, the Republican majority is likely to grow, and that's because in states that have voted for Trump in 2016, now have senators that are up for re-election. In the states where there are blue senators, in states like California, it just doesn't matter. Feinstein, well, by the way, there's not even a Republican in the race. But Feinstein is going to get elected if she were running against a Republican. I think Feinstein would win that race even if she dropped dead in the middle of it. Because it's by virtue of what we are politically, California here. And it's like that elsewhere. It's like that in other blue states. So what's the upside? What's the upside to Chuck Schumer beating his chest and saying, we will put everything we have to fight this nominee? Well, the answer is quite simple. It's fundraising. This is a dog whistle to the Democratic Party base. This is free airtime. They're already fundraising off of this. This is the, hey, we have a fight. We have a fight. You know, abortion, Roe v. Wade. It's over. I mean, if Kavanaugh gets in, I mean, there will not be another Democrat aborted in America. That's basically what we're talking about. That's all I hear on the media. This is all the mainstream media is talking about. They're just obsessed with it. But the reason that the Democrats in the Senate and the reason that the Democrats in the House, although the calculus is a little bit different there, they're talking about it because they want to fundraise first. The second thing that they want to do is this shows to me how desperate they are to motivate their base, how desperate the Democratic Party right now is to get voter engagement come November. I think they realize that while there is this perception amongst themselves within their own echo chamber that Trump is the horrible person, that democracy itself is imperiled by his very existence, let alone the fact that he's in office and president of the United States, that outrage really isn't felt broadly in society, right? People, if anything, people turn on the news, hear that Trump's horrible, but then what the economy's getting better. We're making headway with North Korea. NATO's getting more money, even though we're told that Trump is pissing all over it. It looks like, yeah, trade war, but overall the stock market's going up. I mean, there's nothing here really that backs up the rhetoric. So where the rubber meets the road, Trump is succeeding. If you are a Democrat, I promise you, I know you may not interact with too many of them. But trust me, they're depressed and they are looking for anything they possibly can to get their base motivated, to get their people to the polls. And of course, it's all about money. They need the money, right? They've got candidates to support. So I tell you now why this is going to backfire. It's going to backfire because it's a very dangerous precedent. You don't want to have a confirmation hearing be a party line vote. It's not a party line vote. This is where the Senate comes together and says, yeah, that person's qualified. He may not be my cup of tea, but he's qualified, and it's my duty to vote for him. That's how it's always been. And the Democrats love to mess with tradition. And it always shoots them. They always shoot themselves in the foot. Do you remember Harry Reid? Harry Reid, Senate leader. He comes in, right? A Democrat, Dirty Harry from Nevada. He comes in and he decides to do away. He calls it the nuclear option, right? Does away with the 60-vote rule for Supreme Court justices because, you know, well, we got to get through Barack Obama's nominee and, you know, we're not going to have everybody to vote. So what we're going to do is instead of making the rule 60, simple majority, 51, 51 out of 100. By changing that rule, it helped them in the moment. But now look at it. What do we have? Hey, thanks, Harry Reid. Republicans have enough votes to get this thing along party lines. And more than likely, I suspect there will be a number of vulnerable Democrats that vote for Kavanaugh by virtue of them being in pro-Trump states. You already know this is happening. Doug Jones said this the other day, speaking on CNN with Dana Bash. This is on Monday. Listen closely because he is expressing concern, but at the same time, he's not sounding like Chuck Schumer to me. Play this.
I am concerned about this nomination. I'm concerned about the direction that the court will take. I don't want to see things change that radically. And I think there are some legitimate concerns. That's what I'm going to look at. That doesn't mean I'm going to vote yes. It doesn't mean I'm going to vote no. I think it's premature to say automatically. I'm not going to say automatically that I'm going to vote against any nominee that Donald Trump put out there. That's just not my role. But I'm not going to automatically vote for them either. I want to take a good long look. We've got a long way to go with whoever this nominee is going to be.
Kamala Harris, our wonderful senator here from California, won't even meet with Kavanaugh. Did you hear about this? Her office has turned down any request to communicate with the White House and with the team that is taking Kavanaugh around. Because what happens, just so you understand a little bit of the process, peek behind the curtain. President Trump makes his appointment known, right? He makes his nomination known on Monday. And the very next day, what happens is Kavanaugh will go to the Hill and he'll go to the Senate, not to the Senate chamber. Okay, the confirmation hearings will happen later. The first thing that happens is he goes around and he meets with individual senators. This poor guy, I mean, this is what happens. You basically have to go around and conduct 100 interviews. Like job interviews. Can you imagine applying for a job? And I mean, he's already been interviewed up the yin-yang, right, by all the president's people. Now he has to go in and get interviewed by all these nincompoop senators. Now, it's Kamala Harris's job. It is her literal job. President appoints somebody, advice and consent of the Senate, right? The Senate has to come in and evaluate the nominee. And Harris, our wonderful senator, has blanketly refused to do that. Now, Doug Jones is taking a different take. He's a Democrat from Alabama. He's taking a different take. And his take is, I can't say yes or no. We haven't had the hearings yet. And that's fair. But the reason he's taking that take is because he's out of there. He's not going to be yet. Well, he got put in, right? So he's got 6 years. But my point is, Alabama is a state that is absolutely A-OK with a strong constitutionalist judge. If the judge comes in, if Trump appoints a guy who says, look, I believe in the plain meaning of the Constitution, I'm an originalist, I'm a conservative judge, and their Senator Doug Jones doesn't vote him in, next time he's not going to be running against Roy Moore. I can tell you that right now. He's not running against a bozo. He's going to be running against a real Republican candidate who will wipe the floor with him. And this vote will come back to haunt him in a very major way. So he knows he can't do that. He's between a rock and a hard place. And he's left out there people like Doug Jones, okay, and Joe Manchin from West Virginia. These the red state Democratic senators are being left out to dry by Senate leadership. Because the Senate leadership, what Chuck Schumer wants right now is to raise money. He wants to motivate the base, and consequences be damned. It's going to come back to bite them. I mean, what happens when, isn't this what they want? Does the left, the Democratic Party wants to get rid of Trump. They want to have a Democratic president. So a very real possibility is, I don't think it is, but in their minds, a very real possibility is Republicans would be in the Senate and a Democrat would be in the White House, which means then come Clarence Thomas's death or retirement, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death or retirement, two older justices, you'd have a new appointment or two come in. And now the Republicans in the Senate says, well, you know what, Chuck Schumer, you guys voted on party lines. We're going to vote on party lines, and we're going to take a qualified person and we're going to deny them. We're just going to deny them. It's a terrible precedent. And it's one, I tell you, I promise you, it's one that will bite the Democrats back in the rear. I also don't think that the outrage wing of the Democratic Party actually is a big factor in the election. In elections, period. No. Because Obama's a different factor. For Obama, it wasn't outrage. For Obama, it was enthrallment. They loved Obama. Obama motivated them, but in a positive way. But yelling, screaming, you know, how the sky is falling, I don't know. I don't think that really gets their people to the polls. And it might, of course, it might, if objectively the world really is coming undone. But the longer that Trump is in office and proving that he is not the incompetent boob that he is made out to be, inadvertently, the Democratic Party and, of course, the media, their great enablers, have painted this picture, have set such a low bar for Trump. Right. Trump went into office and we were told that he was going to fall flat on his face. All Trump has to do is have some success, and he's already beating all expectations. Very dangerous the way the media. Another example of how the resistance and how this entire strategy of opposing Trump is blowing up in their faces. This is all important because you've got to understand what this is all about. It has nothing to do with Judge Kavanaugh being qualified. This has nothing to do with his opinions as a judge. This has nothing to do with his qualifications. Any other circumstances, the Democrats, if there weren't an election coming up, would not be throwing this kind of a stink. So that's the scoop there. All right, don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Sam Rejofsky on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Rejofsky, Sam Nation. You know, one really interesting unintended consequence of this, I don't know, the last year and a half, we've all experienced Trump resistance. And I'm not just, this is not just in the context of the Kavanaugh, the fight against Kavanaugh initiated by the Senate and congressional Democrats, Schumer and Pelosi. I'm talking about the broader reaction to Trump's election back in November of 2016, which was loud, which was powerful, admittedly, but also very emotional. And you had these, you had the meow meow hat women's rallies, and you have the sit-ins, and you have the protests, and you have all these opportunities for Democrats, anti-Trump Democrats, to be heard or to voice, to get out their frustrations and their feelings, which, of course, we know these feelings are very important to these people. Where are the Trump people, by the way? Well, the Trump people are sitting quietly. They're cowed into silence, and because you show up somewhere with a Trump hat, you're going to get beat up. They don't even like to really admit that they're Trump supporters. I was out last Friday night after the show and got into it with a friend's sister about... she hit me. I mean, that's how these people are. I'm having a regular, normal conversation with her, and she just did no idea how to debate me, so she hit me because she doesn't like Trump. Now, it wasn't a hard hit, but still, you know. This is the Trump supporter experience. Okay, no one likes you. No one wants to talk to you. But do you know what? You're not alone. The place where Trump supporters have to express their feelings are at the polls. And at the polls, almost exclusively. A lot of people who support Trump that I know don't talk about it amongst themselves, really. Out in public, certainly not on Facebook, or not posting long, driveling posts like my liberal friends all do. Oh, Trump is the worst. Oh, horrible, horrible. Instead, they're just sitting there. They're going to work. They're paying their taxes. They're taking care of raising their kids, driving the carpool, coaching the sports team. And they're going, yeah, 2020, I'm going to vote. Yeah, this guy's doing great. I love it. And I don't place a lot of stock in polls, but you saw that north of 85% approval of Trump among Republicans, right? That is a huge number. And Trump is more popular even, again, if you place any stock in these polls being accurate, Trump is more popular than Barack Obama was at this time during his presidency. And Barack Obama, okay, had the full force and weight of an obsequious media behind him. Trump is running with this massive headwind, which means to me, basically, I mean, look, you know, Obama was competing in the Special Olympics compared to Trump. He was a ringer. And he still had a crappy approval rating. This is, and all of these people out there are all these Democrats who are going to the rallies and going to their support groups and going to, you know, now protesting this Kavanaugh appointment. They're getting it all out. They're getting it all out. They're going to be exhausted by the time November comes around 2018. Forget November 2020. November 2020, they won't even be able to walk. They're going to be so exhausted from all this resisting. And this, I think, is also a major miscalculation. This is also a place where the Democrats really need to just chill. But they can't because everything's an emotional fight. Anyway, we have our Friday Funny segment up next. I think you're going to like this one. Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, back after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Oh, this one is good. This one is great. All right, in Vancouver, Washington, a burglar broke into an escape room. Do you know what an escape room is? Well, the purpose of the escape room is you're supposed to get out of it, not into it. And people do this as team building exercises. People do it on dates or, you know, group dates, that kind of thing. You go into a room, the premise of it. I've never done one of these. Have you? Okay. You go into a room. And they lock you in there, and there's a series of clues that you have to follow to get out of the room. So it's the way I understand it, it can be a little bit of a scavenger hunt where you're going from one thing to the next thing, and it all leads you to a key that unlocks a door, for example, okay, or to a button that opens a hatch or whatnot, and you're doing it under a time limit. Now, this particular escape experience that is in Vancouver, Washington, has an average 50 to 58 minute time for visitors to escape. That is the average time that it takes guests, paying guests, who have not broken in illegally, to get out. The good news is the burglar here took only 35 minutes. So that I don't know what that says for how this business works after hours. I'll tell you what funny thing is. he broke in. He got a beer. He stole a beer. He also stole a burrito. Now, I don't know where the burrito was. That's mysterious, too. But so he steals a beer. He steals a burrito. He eventually escapes. And he starts running down the street and he's apprehended. Well, I like this quote from the police. They said, well, we're going to start claiming that we're the only escape room in the nation that has 100% capture rate for criminals. Vancouver, Washington. I don't know. I don't like being cooped up in tight places. That's my problem with these escape rooms. I don't know. I have another news story here that I actually enjoy, I think, even more. Did you hear about Air Force One getting a makeover? Yeah, this actually, I think, is happening. So there's a new Air Force One that is being built right now. It's been in the works since Obama's years. This is not a Trump project. But it's I think the current Air Force One was put into service in 1991. When George H.W. Bush was president. So it has been a while. Now, even though these planes are maintained to near perfection, if not perfection, they're still getting old. And there's a newer, bigger Boeing 747 out there called the 747-800. And two of these planes have been purchased and are being outfitted as we speak and should go into service around 2021. Now, at issue is the paint color on the 747 that is Air Force One. Do you know what I'm talking about? The paint color is that light blue color. Do you know how far back that goes? The Kennedy era. It was, you know, Jackie Kennedy designed it. There was a famous industrial designer. I had his name here. Raymond Loewy. And it's very iconic, and there are a lot of traditionalists that love it, but Trump, apparently, and some sources are saying, the New York Post is reporting this, that Trump is keenly involved in trying to make the new colors, changing the colors, and making the colors more patriotic. I love it. Yes, I love this idea. First of all, I have read every time I look at Air Force One, I look at it and I think it looks a little bland. It looks like it was designed by someone who, it's just bland. It's a lame color. It looks dated. And Trump wants the plane to be red, white, and blue. Oh my gosh, can you imagine? This is going to look, it's going to look like a Harley Davidson rally somewhere in Sturgis. That's what I'm thinking. I want a bald eagle on this thing. Yeah, you think Trump's going to emblazon his face? Yeah, do you see this? The New York Post put a picture. They've actually got a Trump's head on the tail. And then USA written on the sides. I will tell you, if you look at Trump's plane, he's got the right colors on it. When it comes to airplanes, you don't want bland colors. You want a strong, bold color palette. And look at the airlines, right? The airlines all evolved their liveries, the paint schemes on them over the years to modernize them. It's been a while. It's been over 50 years. Time to freshen it up. And I'm all for this. Even though I'm a traditionalist, I think that this is not a bad way to go. All right, don't go anywhere. Sam Rzhovsky, back after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Yeah, Sam Rzhovsky here. So one of the things when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, one of the things that the Democrats are really going after is this Federalist Society deal, when Trump was running the election, I don't know if you remember this, but he one of his promises that he made in the primaries was that he was going to pick judges from a list that was produced under the advice and counsel of the Federalist Society. Trump did this, by the way, in the primary. It was very important, very strategic, because back then, remember, he was convincing, he had to convince conservatives that he was legit. I still remember in the primaries arguing with people about, you know, debating whether or not Trump was actually a Republican, let alone a conservative. And prominent voices in the conservative community were loudly saying that he was anything but a conservative. And so Trump went out there and he said, OK, this is my list of judges. And that's, by the way, why there was the people knew what the names would be. And Kavanaugh is not a surprise. He was on the list. But what the Democrats are doing now is that they are making a huge issue about what a radical right-wing nut job fringe group the Federal Society is. Here's a little compilation of various senators going to town on this. Listen closely.
The Constitution doesn't direct the president to nominate justices with the advice and consent of the Federalist Society. The Constitution gives that role to the Senate.
I know him from the fact that he appears on the list that the Federalist Society put together of people who will overturn Roe versus Wade.
This nominee has had to run a special interest obstacle course moderated by the Federalist Society. We are going to look into what went on and what assurances were made. There is enormous grounds for suspicion right now about this nominee.
Pre-cleared, pre-approved by far-right organizations like the Heritage Foundation and Federalist Society.
He has already been vetted by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, whose goals are to overturn Roe v. Wade and repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Anyone who gets the good housekeeping seal of approval from Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society is not moderate, is not mainstream, is hard right, and wants to move America back decades.
Okay. I will tell you what the exact verbatim mission statement is of the Federalist Society, which is a 501(c)(3) nonprofit corporation. Quote, to promote the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. If that sounds like a radical statement to you, you're insane. Better put, you're a Democrat. It's that simple. The Federalist Society, incidentally, there's a great piece. Where was this? In the Daily Signal. There's a great piece that every single sitting justice of the Supreme Court, including Kagan and Sotomayor, they've all had dealings with the Federalist Society. For example, Kagan, who was nominated by Barack Obama back in 2010, she spoke to the Federalist Society in 2005. And in her remarks, she even said, quote, I love the Federalist Society. Sotomayor, the wise Latina, who was nominated in 2009, that same year, she addressed a Federalist meeting. All justices, I mean, this is not a fringe group. So once again, it's this, it's crazy hyperbole that is driving the messaging from the Democratic Party. It's fascinating to me. It's absolutely insane. Yeah, Ginsburg too, Anthony Kennedy, Stephen Breyer, they all have addressed Federalist Society meetings, all attended Federalist Society meetings. The Federalist Society has even Democrats in it. This is not it's for people, it's for lawyers, and a lot of young lawyers, by the way, early on in their careers will join it because it becomes a way that you can get noticed, especially if you want to make a career as a judge. Or a federal prosecutor, there's a lot of good connections to be made. I mean, this is not a right wing fringe group at all. But it speaks volumes that the Democratic Party wants to make strict interpreting of the Constitution a fringe issue. The only thing fringe is them wanting to rewrite the Constitution based on feelings and not based on the law. Don't go anywhere. I'll be back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Marjowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
My last point, I think, is really important because, so again, law is actually inherently conservative. When you call the Federalist Society this right-wing fringe group, you're forgetting is that law requires sober interpretation. It's black and white, like that TSA case. The statute is clear. The judge's responsibility is not to insert their ethics or their personal beliefs. It's to look at the law and that words have plain meaning. And this is why everybody's frustrated. By the way, this is why Kavanaugh's going to get in. I mean, all the posturing and everything. Look, even the Washington Post got this. The Ruth Marcus, who's a writer for the Washington Post, said, look, the red state Democrats, they can't afford to mess with this. Listen to what she says.
The politics are really clear. You have to be able to get to a majority of votes against the nominee. I will be stunned if it's one of the two folks, Kavanaugh or Hardiman, if they end up voting against them. Why would Democrats in those red states sort of go on the suicide, political suicide mission? Why would Chuck Schumer, the leader, want them to go on the suicide mission?
I know it's really hard for you as a writer for The Washington Post to understand why Democrats are on a suicide mission, but they are. And they are because they are stuck in their own echo chamber and think that they are so morally correct and that the sky is falling. Meanwhile, Trump soldiers on, the world is continuing, America is prospering. And it's because all of their closely held beliefs, as embodied by Barack Obama and others, are crap. Trump is representative of who America is. And we're rallying behind him. And most of us, virtually all of us, are doing it quietly. But we do vote and we do show up every election. Now, the last thing today I got to still mention is there were some fireworks on Capitol Hill today. Peter Strzok, the Romeo FBI agent who was romancing one of his colleagues and trash talking Trump as he was doing it. He was also involved in the investigation working for Mueller, all this stuff. There were some fireworks. Louie Gohmert, this is my favorite Republican from Texas, talking to him, questioning him about if he's lying. And he went low. I mean, Miss Michelle Obama, she goes high, but you know, well, listen to this.
I've talked to FBI agents around the country. You've embarrassed them. You've embarrassed yourself. And I can't help but wonder when I see you looking there with a little smirk, how many times did you look so innocent into your wife's eye and lie to her about Lisa?
Mr. Chairman, this is outrageous.
The credibility of a witness
shame
is always
on you,
an
Chairman.
Issue.
Mr. Chairman, this is an intolerable harassment of the witness.
What's wrong with that? You need your medication.
No, oh, you need your medication. Was that? Who was that? It sounds like Maxine Waters. It's a fair question. If you've got a witness on the stand and their credibility is at issue and they're having an affair and they're an admitted liar in the context of their marriage, it speaks to character. It's admissible in a court of law. I don't know. But you see that reaction. They don't want to go, no, this is outrageous. Talk over him. I'm telling you, all this resistance, all this effort going into stopping Trump, it's not working. It's getting zero traction. And it's ruining them. It's destroying the Democratic Party. None of this is good. All right. I know we're a day early, but have a great weekend. Happy Friday. Happy Saturday, Sunday. We'll be back here next week, next Friday at our usual time. Friends, I'm so grateful to be here. Sayonara. We'll be right back.